You are listening to the Anormocast.
I don't know what's happening in your neck of the woods, but out here in the great American West, it's the start of desert crack season, which means two things. The bros are charging up their Bluetooth speakers, and people are wondering where the hell they're going to get enough cans. But Black Diamond has your back. On top of the heap are the Camelot Ultralights, cams so fleet that Elon Musk once shot one into space strapped to a bottle rocket. And then there's the venerable C4, the cam that still rules the creek. And legend has it, if you whisper Camelot, Camelot, Camelot into a mirror while holding a red C4 to your forehead, the location of the easiest for you 12-minus will be revealed. And don't forget the dinky Camelot X4s and X4 offsets. But do forget about clean underwear if you start whipping on the .1 in sandstone. But wherever your crack reveals itself, remember, BD has you covered with the sweetest cams known to man. Check them all out at blackdiamondequipment.com or your favorite local shop. So I've been laying on the TC Pro from Sportiva for the last few months, like your annoying friend trying to get you to read the Harry Potter books, because, you know, they're not just for children. Spoiler, they are. But what if you're like, Chris, I don't climb slabs like some muscle-bound bonobo. I'm more like a gazelle. You know, if a gazelle had opposable thumbs and a moderately popular Instagram feed. Well then, my little bovidae, look no further than the Futura from Sportiva. Refined by the world's best climbers, the Futura excels in steep precision footwork, and the no-edge technology gives them unparalleled sensitivity, just like you. So if you want to go from prey to predator on those steep sport climbs and boulders, check out a pair of Futuras at Sportiva.com or your favorite local shop.
We gotta get Listen, where are you playing in town? Are you playing here?
We're doing the Normo Dome, whatever it is. It's terrific.
Oh,
it's
yeah, big house. Place outside of town. That's a big place. You sold it out. I'll say.
You really should.
Look, you better get up there before you panic. Those pens are loose. You're very good. I have really enjoyed climbing with you.
We'll make it.
I don't think so, but we shall continue with style.
Good weather, bad weather. Now or later, anytime.
Today's show is brought to you by Black Diamond Equipment, with support from Maxim Ropes.
And the fine folks at La Sportiva. And don't forget our charter sponsor, Bonfire Coffee. Go to bonfirecoffee.com and enter Norma at checkout for a discount on great coffee and to support the Normacast.
And now back to the show.
Hello and welcome to the Normacast. This is your host, Chris Galoos. It's about 10 a.m. daylight savings time here in Colorado. The dark time is past. March 14th, 2019, and this is episode 171 of the Enormacast, conversation with climber Mark Twite. And this turned out to be one of the longest interviews that I've ever gotten on the Enormacast, and so I've cut it into two episodes. This will be part one, and it's still a solid hour and a half. So by the time we're all finished with this, we hit into 3 hours, but I definitely think it's worth it, and I sort of fretted about trying to edit it down and get it into sort of a smaller package. And then I remembered that this is the Enormacast and I can do whatever I want, actually. And you guys would expect me to give you the whole enchilada. That's the game over here. You get everything. The cheese, the tangy sauce, the meaty center, you know, that weird soggy lettuce on the side that you're never going to eat. So dig in for these two awesome and in-depth interviews with Mark Twite. But let me talk a little bit about my weird and convoluted relationship with Mark Twite. And if you're nearing my age, if you came up climbing in the 80s and 90s, early 2000s, then you probably have a similar relationship with Mark Twite. The interesting thing about Mark is that he had a reputation in those years, those decades, for being sort of a punk rock alpinist, angry young man. He was prone to sort of calling out ethical lapses in public. His writing was angry, fast-paced, kind of a new idea of how to relate climbing, which we talk about in here. And frankly, he was a little bit scary. His nickname, I don't know if he chose it or the media chose it, or even it's possible that John Sherman chose it, was Dr. Doom. And he sort of put out this idea of alpinism as sort of a death march. And that affected me as a young climber who actually did, in fact, dream of being an alpinist at one point. And I did do some in my deep, deep past. I just happened to move to California in there somewhere, and those sunny rock climbs just took over. However, I was influenced, and instead of scaring me off, like a lot of 20-somethings, all that imagery, that scary imagery, just made me more stoked. And like many of my peers, had an image of Mark Twight that was kind of set in stone about this sort of scary guy, this angry guy. And I carried that with me for the last 20 years, even though I haven't heard too much about Mark Twight. But his influence remains. He wrote two very influential books, one called Extreme Alpinism, which was one of the first manuals about how to go fast and light in the mountains, how to train for climbing, all that sort of thing. And then he published a collection of his essays that had appeared in magazines in the 80s and 90s called Kiss or Kill, The Confessions of a Serial Climber. And in the history of the Normacast, I think I've gotten more requests to have Mark Twight on than just about anybody. But frankly, I was a little scared of Mark Twight. I didn't know what he would think of this goofy little podcast that we do over here. And I didn't really know how to get in touch with him. Although that might have just been me pretending, because I was worried what he would say. And when I finally did get in touch with him, I got his contact through a mutual friend, Brittany Griffith, who said, yeah, you need to get in touch with him. He's a great guy. Don't worry about it. I okayed it with him. Just send him an email. So I sent him an email about the podcast, my normal pitch. And the email I got back, Mark and I now laugh about it for various reasons, which I'll get to in a second. And I'm not revealing any sort of secret here. When I quote the very first line of the email I received back from Mr. Twight, the title of the email was, "Let's start with this." And the first line was, "I hate modern journalists and podcasts in general, period." And instead of being pissed off or bummed out or insulted, I just thought it was amazing, because it fit right in to the Mark Twight that lived in my psyche from when I first started climbing. He did leave the door open, though, because he asked me, well, why do you want to interview me? So I gave him a litany of reasons, and we started a bit of a dialogue. And actually, Mark did, in the end, agree to do the podcast, although somewhat reluctantly, I felt. And then his schedule and my schedule just made it sort of impossible for quite some time, and it fell onto the back burner again. And then, lo and behold, onto my podcast feed pops the Dissect Podcast. Mark and some creative partners had started their own podcast about a year after I got that email, which, of course, really cracked me up. And I was like, wait a minute. So then I finally sent him another email and said, hey, saw you had a podcast, you know, kind of laughing about it. And finally, Mark and I, now having this understanding about what podcasting was all about, and Mark had listened to mine and also found the Aid Rant, which he enjoyed, we started having a dialogue. And then in the end, the cool thing is that suddenly Mark was the guy that was really pushing to get this thing done and invited me up to Salt Lake. And when I showed up at his place up there and walked through the door, I was still this nervous 20-year-old from 1992, worried about meeting, you know, if not a hero, at least this guy who again, I'd created this mythology around. And from the moment that Mark walked out and we shook hands, it was amazing. He was gracious. He was forthcoming. He was excited that I was there. We went out to dinner and finally sat down in his studio, the Dissect studio, for a solid 3 hours from about 9:30 to 12:30 midnight. And we got a lot of good stuff. So that's the story of Mark Twight. And again, if some of you guys grew up reading about Mark Twight or reading his writing, then you might really identify with this story, this idea that I had sort of a mythology around this guy that has now been broken down. Once I was done with this interview, I really felt like I had a better understanding of who he is and who he was at that time. And also, I ended up with a lot more respect than I ever had for Mark Twight. And that respect begins with the fact that Mark was willing to eat crow about his initial contact and about podcasting in general. He's a big fan of the medium now, and I think it works really well for his voice and what he and his partners do over there at Dissect. And that's where we kind of open this this interview, is him talking about that mistake that he might have made and admitting that he's made a few mistakes, which is part of what makes this interview so good. So buckle in. This one's very Enormacasty, but I hope you like listening as much as I did when I was sitting across from Mark in the studio.
Yeah, I've been wrong about a lot of things
in my life.
Right. Okay,
that's a good place to start.
Yeah, and I mean, wrong and vocally so.
Right.
And then realize, like, this is actually kind of a cool way to do something, to communicate in an organic way that that doesn't, like, because I go back and, you know, you say, yeah, Kiss or Kill was influential at a certain time. I would have to agree with you. But if I go back and read some of that stuff now, and I just, like, the Italians are producing a second edition, and so they're going to do new layout. And so the day before yesterday, I wrote a new introduction for the second edition in Italian or whatever. And so I, you know, go back every now and then and read some of that stuff, and I go, man, yeah, that's not right.
Well, I just reread it, and another aside, I reread it while passing a kidney stone, so I felt a certain affinity to the things you were going through.
To the pain?
Yeah, to the pain.
I had voluntarily...
But yeah, let's actually, we're talking about it. So
yeah,
the book is called Kiss or Kill: Confessions of a Serial Alpinist or Serial Climber.
Serial Climber.
Okay,
yeah.
Serial Climber.
It's close to Serial Killer.
Yeah, right. Oh, I get it.
Yes. Nice. Stole it. I stole the title.
And came out what year? Do you remember?
2001.
Okay, 2001. So, right.
So Extreme Alpinism was 1999. Kiss or Kill was 2001.
Okay, but the reason I'm confused is because it's a compilation.
Yes,
of previous articles.
Stuff, yeah. So it's basically 25 essays that were written between 1984 is the first one, and then 2000 is the last one.
Okay, so the book came out, the essays were out there, because that's confusing to me, because I actually, in a class at Colorado State circa 1990,
okay,
I stood in front of a bunch of lit majors.
Ouch.
And read The Abattoir.
Oh, that went down like...
I'm
sure everyone totally identified.
If it had been like 2016, 2015, they would have called security.
Yeah.
Or at least alerted, you know, the counselors at the school that there's this kid in this class that
he's totally identifying with this guy who's writing in what he had called first person posthumous, which is essentially what, you know, it was. Just splattered on the rocks, and now I'm writing about it.
Yeah, that was the fiction. It was a fiction class, so I knew that I was dealing with fiction. So
yeah,
but that's you know, the kid that I was, and I think there was a whole my generation, and I was a little bit behind you. I'm 10 years or so younger than you are. And,
I think exactly. Right?
Yep. And so, you know, this influence, this idea that alpinism was, I guess, this sort of dark path of introspection and you know, harrowing kind of pain was a little bit ingrained in us, to the point where a friend of mine, you know, when I first was talking to you about doing the show, he was just like, that guy, like, I never knew you could have fun alpine climbing. And so this is the kind of thing that, I mean, it was a terribly influential period. The book came out a little bit later, but you're writing through those two decades.
Yeah.
You know, really, I'm actually wondering, I guess, we'll get to it now, is were you aware of what these things were sort of hooking these jumper cables to guys like me and a, you know, young alpinists that were coming up? Or were you just spitting them into the world and seeing what was going to happen?
No, I was not, let's say a decade into it maybe, or whatever, when I think I found my voice a little bit, I started to get an idea, or you know, if that people were actually reading them. And I'm like, no, I didn't mean that. Don't do that thing.
I think that's a realization a lot of authors have.
But eventually the people are actually reading it, and then they're like, you know, going and setting buildings on fire, or, you know, or whatever, like weird, you know, thing that the protagonist did in the book. Or, so in the beginning, I wasn't aware. For me, I was reacting against something else, something that was, that had already happened in a way, or like this establishment of an idea, you know, the sort of, like, if you look in the sort of gold and silver ages of alpinism, I mean, it was a very romantic ideal to go into the mountains and have these sort of beautiful experiences and not necessarily talk about them in the way of having conquered nature or anything like that. So there was this romantic notion, and to me, that can only happen when you're in an environment and very comfortable with it. And something that Jeff Lowe had said after reading Kiss or Kill, that like the original Kiss or Kill article, which Michael Kennedy graciously basically published, you know, I think he changed one word and published it sort of unedited. And it was, you know, that was sort of the blueprint for the rest of my career. And that came out in 1987. But Jeff Lowe read it and thought like, wow, I was with you on that thing. And his experience was totally different because he was in an environment that he was fully adapted to. He was a competent climber. He was a visionary. He was a guy at the top of his game in 86 when we went. And I was on my first trip to the Himalayas, my third trip out of the United States. I was freaked out most of the time, like completely and utterly scared and uncomfortable. And I was trying to write that experience without saying I was scared. And I had also read a lot of climbing expedition books and realized that, you guys go on a trip to the Himalayas and it takes almost as long to read the book as it did for you to drive overland from, you know, England or wherever to get to the Himalayas and try and climb this thing. And I thought, I can just, you know, I'm into punk rock. I can do the, you know, 1 minute, 30 second version of this. Jeff and I spent 9 days trying to climb the South Pillar of Nipsey, and I was able to address that in whatever punk rock way in 1,500 words. And I thought, this is what this should be about. This shouldn't be some laborious fucking book where you need an armchair. I think I want to write an article you can read sitting on the toilet.
Right. Yeah. So the punk rock thing is also the one of the big distinctive parts of a lot of those early articles. The inclusion of lyrics, you know, probably most famously Skinny Puppy, but a lot of these, and you know, it's, I guess I'm not sure what the vernacular is. Probably post punk, somewhere involved in that.
I don't think I included in any articles genuine. What would, you know, if we want to like hash down to the details, any real punk rock, but it was certainly post and a lot of dark wave, and then you know. And the reason for it, people are like, why did you use those lyrics? And I couldn't say at the time because I didn't understand. But now I look back and I realize, like, due to my inability to write, I had to use other people's words to create an image that I couldn't create on my own because I was totally sort of self-taught writer and I was like casting about. And some of the stuff that came out later in the Kiss or Kill book, I mean, I had to go back and rewrite because when I read it in the year 2000, when I was working on that collection of essays, I'm like, oh my God, this is fucking horrible. I can kick that thing's ass now. And so some of those things got rewritten with 15 years or 10 years more advanced facility with the written word.
So can we go back to the punk rock kid?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I assume it came first, the punk rock obsessed kid. And I guess lead us to the nexus where it happened, where you were like, climbing is an expression of these same ideas I have in my head.
That's a curious way to put it, but maybe it's right. There was a point where I was pretty obsessed with what I would at the time have called, you know, well, I wouldn't have at the time. It was just music. I went to a lot of live shows. I listened to a lot of prog rock. I saw Rush 3 times in concert. The first show I actually saw, first live show I ever went to see, was Thin Lizzy opening for Queen on the Bohemian Rhapsody tour.
Nice.
And there was a girl, Joanna something, in high school, and she was like 2 years ahead of me in school, and she was into the whole, she was super into Bowie and that, and she said, Queen is coming, you have to go. I'm like, what's Queen? I just I was at that show. Phil Lynott was fucking amazing, like during the Thin Lizzy set, and I was utterly blown away. I was just like, fuck, okay, that's very Mercury. A person can actually do that.
Right.
A person can sing like that, can move like that, can absolutely hold that crowd in the palm of his hand. And then I saw Yes, I saw Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. I mean, you name a big fucking prog rock band in that era, and I saw them, you know, at the Seattle Coliseum or at the Arena or the Paramount or someplace.
Right, so you're in Seattle.
So I'm in Seattle. Grew up, okay. I mean, was born in Yosemite, lived there a little over 2 years, moved to Mount Rainier, and lived there for 3 years, and then Seattle to go to school.
The formative years.
Yeah. I'm a child of the Pacific Northwest, and don't own a single plaid shirt. When I was 10, my parents got divorced, and I ended up with a stepbrother. And somewhere in that time frame, and I don't know if it's sort of I'm going to go with 77, 78-ish time frame. I was back east to see my dad for Christmas. It was right when the second Clash album came out, which was Give Him Enough Rope. And then and the Devo album, the first Devo record, was out. My stepbrother brought those home, and he was listening to them. And that changed, that's what it was. You know, Give Him Enough Rope changed my fucking life. I went back to Seattle. I had 113 prog rock, you know, albums. I took them to Cellophane Square. I sold them. And,
wow.
And that, I mean, I became a fucking punk, you know, a punk, quote unquote.
Right.
Which, you know, you can't be growing up in fucking middle class America, you know, by the true definition. But I became a punk overnight. Because I heard that song. I came home, I bought the first two albums by the Ramones, I bought the Sex Pistols record, and that was it.
Geddy Lee was out.
Geddy Lee was out. I was like, those guys, that, you don't need that many fucking drums, Neil. And if you're Geddy Lee, you got to play keyboard with your feet because right. Your fingers are busy and your mouth is, like, incredible musicians. I listen to them now. And I got righteous about it. As anything I was into, I kind of get righteous about. And then later I recover and I go, you know, Geddy's fucking man.
Yeah, he's a good bass player.
Yeah, and Alex Lifeson. I mean, that'd just be my underhand, my sideways shout out to Kurt Smith.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fellow Rush.
Well, this
fan.
Is quite a confessional, actually. The punk rocker that listened to prog rock. I mean, that's a pretty good Normacast exclusive right there. So, again, let's keep working on this picture of you in Seattle, kid who flipped over to punk rock. Where does climbing fit into it, or when does that appear in the scene?
So, having sort of grown up, you know, around mountains. But I was a park ranger, which is why I happened to be born in Yosemite. I was actually born in the clinic there. So I can say I was like born in the valley. Mm-hmm. And then we rode to Hanapakosh, which is, you know, one of the sort of campgrounds and places near Cayuse Pass in at Mount Rainier. And then it was time for me to go to school. He wanted to get a PhD. And so we moved down to Seattle. My dad was not a climber. He was very risk averse, in fact. He wasn't sort of your interpretive ranger. He was a law enforcement park ranger, which means he was a federal cop, which I just, you know, use that to sort of excuse my issues with authority.
Right.
that I sort of have always had. But despite moving to the city, every weekend we would either go, you know, overnight, sort of backpacking in the summer, or skiing at the Mountaineers Lodge at Snoqualmie Pass in the winters. So I'd always had, you know, sort of a relationship with the outdoors and the mountains. And there were books in the house about mountains. There was always the REI catalog. You could count on a good photo of Walter Bonatti in the REI catalog whenever it came out at that time. And so I got enamored with these stories about climbing. And sometime, I think in 1979, for my birthday, my mom gave me a copy of The White Spider. And I graduated from high school that year. And I've just decided, like, I really think that I want to try and do this. Being, I could run 2 miles from my house down to the artificial rock wall at the University of Washington, which is sort of one of the first outdoor, you know, artificial rock walls. Mm-hmm. I think Sherman Rock was the other one that was in Seattle at the time. And I would go down there a lot of times at night because it was lit, and I would just hang out and I would try and climb up stuff, and I'd fall down into the gravel, and then I'd maybe just sort of standard progression. there was a point there in Seattle. I was bussing tables at a restaurant, and right behind the restaurant was a store called Early Winters. Bill Nicolai had started that company with a guy named Mark Fielding. Bill Edwards and Ron Zimmerman came in later, and Nicolai had designed the Omnipotent, which was this four pole, you know, tunnel tent. Nicolai had this this integrated rainfly double wall tent thing, and then they started a company, and they started making Gore-Tex garments and this and that. That was right behind this restaurant, and every time I had a break or lunch, I would go over and hang out with those guys, talk to them about climbing. And there was a guy there named Dave Kahn, and I consider him my first climbing mentor. And eventually he said, you know, this restaurant thing, man, you should just get a job with the company. And, you know, you can't work in the retail store because you're a punk kid who knows fuck all, but you could get a job in the Early Winters factory, which is also in Seattle, down on 3rd and Yesler. And that's, I went and applied for a job, and I got a job. My first job there was cutting fiberglass tent poles. So I'd dress up in a full sort of Gore-Tex suit. Because when you're cutting fiberglass with power tools, this fucking fiberglass dust goes everywhere. So I had like a respirator mask and these goggles, and I would cut these tent poles, and then I'd glue the couplers on, and then thread the shock cord through them. That was my first job in the outdoor industry. And there were two guys there, a guy named Brad Keith and another guy named Andy. And I was thinking about this earlier. I'm like, what the fuck was Andy's family name? Don't remember. I told them that I was a climber. But I'd never been,
right?
Except for the University of Rockwall. So they go, hey, we're going this next weekend to Pashaston Pinnacles. Do you want to come? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'll go with you guys. Fuck, I'm finally going to go. Are we going to use ropes? Anyway, so I show up with a pair of like Vasque Hiker 2 boots. Their sticky rubber was around, and they had rock shoes, but I didn't, which they obviously knew immediately that I had never been before, or I would have appropriate footwear. Anyway, but I had a harness and this and that, and we went climbing, and so I top roped some stuff at Pashaston, and the next day, they said, hey, we're going to go up and do outer space on Snow Creek Wall. Sort of 5'8"-ish, six pitches, or eight, and I think the rock face is 1,000 feet or something, and we got a fair ways up there, and I kind of fucking freaked out.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Turned out I'm afraid of heights, essentially. And sort of from that cascade of events, that would have been sort of 1980. And then I went on with Dave Kahn, drove out to the Tetons probably a month after my first experience. I had bought crampons. I bought a pair of foot fangs. I bought a low Big Bird because they were like, that was the highest tech stuff at the time. I'd tried to climb the pear tree in my backyard with the ice axe and the crampons, and ended up with having to get stitches in my head when the tool popped. And, you know, I didn't wear a helmet until I don't know when, really.
Right.
So I went on this mountain instructor and training course in the Tetons, which was put on by Exum because Dave was going out, and I just kind of paid and faked my way into it again. And the instructors are, it was Dave Carman, Harry Frischman, Peter Lev, Kim Schmitz, Chuck Pratt, Yvon Chouinard. Those are the instructors on this course. They're like my first climbing instructor. I mean, it was like the fucking A-team came out.
Yeah, totally.
And I ended up doing the upper west face of the Grand with Les Lloyd leading. So Yvon was leading the rope, traverse out the Owen Spaulding and find these ice runnels out there. And so we traversed out, and Les led every pitch, and I just, you know, was like losing my, every time we, you know, I'd look down and fucking lose my mind again. But that was sort of my first time ice climbing, was this incredible experience with, you know, watching Yvon do his thing. Like, yeah, one axe, one, you know, pair of crampons, not that hard. Why place any gear? It's not hard. Let's just do this. Fantastic.
So what were you doing to deal with the heights thing? Just getting used to it?
I kept trying, starting to climb with a guy in Seattle named Andy Nock, who had come into the Early Winter store and a very forward thinking guy. And I was having these fantasies about climbing and what I was going to do with it. And this guy, Australian guy named Michael Reinberger, had come through and I'd met him at the Early Winter store. And he was on his way back from trying to climb Chang'e-Bang. And he ended up in the Early Winter store in Seattle. We started talking about climbing, and he told me about there's this thing called the Fang on that glacier below Chang'e-Bang. It's a 6,000 meter peak. And he said, the east face of this thing, the granite is so white you can't tell when it turns from snow to rock. It's the most amazing thing. I'll send you some pictures of it. I'm a young kid. I'm like, So, you know, I start like trying to find anything I could in any book ever of the Fang. And there were actually found a couple of pictures in Dougal Haston's book about climbing Changabang. And then Reinberger actually eventually sent me the two prints of this face. And I was like, fuck, that's what I'm going next year. A ridiculous fucking thing that is to think.
So what? How old are you at that point?
20.
Okay.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah, 20. It was at 81. Sometime that winter, I was out with Andy. We climbed the North Face of Dragon Tail in winter in Telemark ski boots because we had to ski up to the thing. And then we were on the Twin Sisters, which are near Mount Baker, and we'd climbed the North Face of the North Twin Sister, and I think we're going over to the South Face, and I kind of flipped out and told Andy I got to go down. He's like, the fucking weather's perfect. The climbing's not that hard. I'm just like, I can't be here. And then he just said, you need to get your shit together, man. You talk about like going to the Himalayas next year and all this great stuff you're going to do, and you're fucking afraid of heights. You can't deal with your fear. You need to get, you know, to do something. I was like, oh my God, no one's ever talked to me this way. That time I was busting tables in a different restaurant. One of the guys there, a guy named Gary Smith, Vietnam vet, very capable fellow, was studying at the Seattle Kung Fu Club. And I kind of explained this whole story to him, and he just goes, dude, you got to quit climbing. You need to start studying martial arts. You're never going to get a handle on your mind unless you do this. And I'll take you down to the school, and I will introduce you, and after that, you're on your own. And he did. And we would work shifts through the night. My shift at that restaurant was 10 at night till 5 in the morning. And, you know, we'd get off work. I'd go to his place. He taught me how to play Go, and I think I probably did a lot of cocaine with him and, you know, because it's the restaurant business. Why, you know, why wouldn't you? And then I started studying. I spent a year or so at the Seattle Kung Fu Club under Sifu John Leong, very basic stuff. And then 3 or 4 months, something like that, at a different school afterwards. And then started climbing again. And it was, and that the whole martial arts experience was sort of life altering in that way. That, and it wasn't like I'm master of my fear or anything. Just like I'm comfortable with it because I've been having to look at, you know, deal with people who are trying to punch me. And that was close enough, you know, for my brain at the time to, and I didn't come back. I wouldn't say I came back and I'm like, now I'm a fearless climber or whatever. I was always a scared climber to the last day I ever went climbing. But there, that process of going through that sort of martial arts experience and not climbing at all during that full on 1 year. And then I started again, another young kid who was working in the restaurant. I always, and now I can't, Mark. And his family, you know, it's just shitty to get old, man. You start losing your memory. I used to blame it on high altitude.
The fact that you even can attempt to recall his name is impressive. So like, don't worry about it at all.
He's called the other Mark.
Right.
That was what, because we were both
right.
Mark.
Marks.
And we started rocking. I mean, he was quite accomplished. He's been to Yosemite. We would climb at Index in Leavenworth. We eventually did. We thought we did the first descent of the west face of the Kolchak Balanced Rock. It was a route that I named Death Party. Because why wouldn't you? It's a Gun Club song, actually, right. And it was off a 5-song EP that came out after the Miami record.
See, you're not getting old. You can recall. Yeah,
there's certain
facts.
Things I can recall, anyway. But we went up and did what I thought was the first descent, and then some other local, I think a guy named Tom Bowman or something, had done it a couple of years earlier. And then I'd gone back and actually 2 years later probably and freed it with Dan Lopeska, sort of 511D-ish thing. I tried to solo it in the winter once and got up there and, you know, 4 or 5 pitches up and got stopped by a storm. And
so
my Northwest climbing experience.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's pretty extensive. I thought it was sort of like you had been up there and then kind of instantly bailed to the greater ranges, but no. I mean, obviously you're putting in the time. Let me ask you a couple questions.
Yeah, because I can see you've been furiously sort of noting.
I'm waiting to get into it. But, you know, one thing that I think defines at least a lot of the narrative around you is this idea of, is that you go in super deep. Like when you find something, you go in super deep. And then reading your writing, you know, it's like you can be black and white, like podcasting. Okay, now I'm good with it. You know, like,
yeah.
So help me understand like that part of this punk rock kid, this kid that was getting into climbing. Like the reason I ask this is because, you know, there's a lot of these sort of very important decisions that you made, and you said you were 20 years old, and then you stopped climbing, you go do martial arts, and the things that were going on around you with other 20-year-olds, did it just go by, or you just didn't have time for, I mean, what was your attitude towards what most 20-year-olds would be doing at that point?
And as soon as I started climbing, I don't think I noticed another 20-year-old for till I discovered girls or so. Right. I don't know. I mean, I joke about that. But I don't think I noticed necessarily, other than, you know, if I would go to a live music show or,
right,
you know, I was dating a girl who was my age or something like that. But as soon as I got focused on climbing, it's all I wanted. I mean, it was, you know, when people joke about, yeah, we ate and slept and breathed, you know, X.
Right.
It was kind of that, because I had an, in my imagination, who I could be, you know, what my potential was, who I could become. And obviously, because of the things that I had read and written, I mean, read that had been written, the people that I admired for their, you know, it's Bonatti, it's Messner, it's Wojtek. I mean, these are the, and I had no doubt that I was going to be one of them.
Right.
But knowing and being fairly, I mean, very cognizant of my actual capability, mm-hmm, at the time, I realized, okay, there's only one way to do this, and it's to do it all in.
Right. Well, we talked earlier tonight about a friend of ours who we thought, you know, was extremely successful, but the amount of success never really convinced her that she was successful, despite, so in other words, the evidence was there that she was successful, and yet she sort of pretended it wasn't there, no matter how much it mounted. It sounds like in some ways there was a little bit of the opposite with you, like, oh, I'm afraid of heights. And were you getting good feedback from these people around you in terms of, like, or were they like your friend that was like, dude, you're supposed to go to the Himalaya? Give me a break. Like, beat it. You know, what was your sort of fantasy versus the evidence around you? Where was it?
Whatever I was doing, it changed my idea pretty quickly, in the sense that yeah, I got some negative feedback. You know, Andy Knock, I mean, he definitely saw the you know, the hole, the problem.
Right.
But having him identify that was, you know, quite helpful, because many times we don't know why we fail at things or why we can't do what we want to do. But having someone sort of ruthlessly point that out, became, you know, was very helpful in a way. But just to say that, like, from 81 when that happened, and we were already kind of like doing stuff,
rad stuff, yeah.
You know, I mean, because again, he was very forward thinking. So to go and climb, you know, the North Face of Dragon Tail, in ski boots, or to go up and, you know, we'd gone in 1 year to try and do complete North Ridge of Mount Stewart in the winter. And we get there, and John Stoddard, John Tarver, and one other guy, that was a rope of three, it might have been Cluin, they were already there on it. And so we were just like, okay, they're already trying it. You know, etiquette basically says we got to go do something else. So Andy and I did the climb the Ice Cliff Glacier route and watched those guys on the North Ridge, which they didn't make it that time. But so I was just like, kept trying these hard things because I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to.
Right.
And, or that it was hard and that I needed to have at least 5 years experience before I go to try that thing. Well, fuck it. That's the beautiful thing about climbing, is you can go try the hardest route in the world tomorrow. Like, there's no, you don't have to like beat all these other teams. You don't have to go through like an organized playoff kind of thing. It's there, it's available. You're going to fail on that route. But you have the opportunity, and you have the opportunity to travel where these routes are. It is sort of like, I think it's one of the most, you know, free, if you will, not financially, but just like open sports, because you decide your own level of involvement. So I was already doing these things, and then by probably it would have been 83, I was working in a North Face store in Seattle, and John Krakauer came in, and he'd got an assignment from Climbing Magazine to do an ice tool review, and he needed someone to go do it, and so we went to get, you know, I was like, I'm game. Yeah, let's go. And so we went and did this thing. And then, it would be hard. I'd have to kind of look, I'd have to go back and look at some old writing to figure out what and why he thought I might be qualified to go with him to the North Face of the Eiger. but he got an assignment from Outside Magazine, and he didn't have a partner, and somehow was able to convince them that, you know, I could take pictures, and he was going to need a photographer as well as a climbing partner. And so my first trip outside of the U.S., apart from going to Canada for a swim meet or some shit, was to fly to Switzerland, fly to Zurich, and take the train and go to try climb the Eiger with John. And that would have been September of 84.
Okay.
When that went down. And that was it. That was like, and then the floodgates were open.
Right. Because now you're standing below the Eiger. So, the white spider, the whole thing.
So fucking terrifying.
Right.
Like, except I was also, for some reason, super confident. I was there with John, who's right. got, you know, as far as like track record goes, the guy is baller. I mean, to solo the Devil's Thumb, you know, back in the day, First Ascent of Ham and Eggs, you know, bunch of stuff in and around Alaska, like, you know, and so I was certainly confident in him that if I had any sort of, you know, I showed up with any weakness that he would be able to cover. We ended up in the total shit weather, you know, our tent camp destroyed by the fun, et cetera. But, you know, whatever. And it was like the wettest September since 1864 when we were there. And we basically sat there for 3 weeks in bad weather. And then there was one sort of period where there's a forecast of like a good day and a half. John said, look, I got some friends who've climbed this. It's going to take us this long. And so I don't want to go up until we have like a 3 day forecast. So there's one night, there's like a, you know, day and a half, maybe there's going to be good weather. I'm like, okay, we're not going up there. And we're staying at Kleine Scheidegg. And so the series of hotels and little train station there below the Eiger. And that night there happened to be a party, and yeah, fuck it. Yeah. I drank some, I took some painkillers, and sometime around 2 a.m, I was like, I'm going to go climbing. And so I went back to our tent, which had not yet been destroyed by the fun, and packed some shit. And like, I'm going to go solo North Face of the Monk. I think Haston did a route up there, and I know it's got to be that couloir on the right side of the face. And so I started, put my headlamp on and started walking, and, you know, walked up the railroad tracks and then cut off and crossed over the glacier, fell and, you know, punched through into a couple of crevasses. They, you know, did the Jesus move a couple of times to sort of stop myself from going further. Didn't end up going further. Sun comes up, I'm at the bottom of that face. I look down what I've just done.
Right.
And realize, okay, I can't go, I'm not going back. Now I gotta climb. And this was sort of perfect samurai tradition of put your back against the wall. Hmm. And so the only way out for me was up. So that was the first hard route or big route that I soloed. I mean, it's TD plus or whatever is what they would call it. There's probably some sections of 80 degree ice. And so I got up that thing and traversed across the upper part of the Guji face and then dropped down to the train station at, you know, whatever, the little call between the Eiger and the, or between the monk and the Jungfrau. You know, I got on a train and I came back down and like, and then my life was, and from that point, my life was forever changed because
right.
Eventually the weather got good. John and I tried the North Face of the Eiger. In his wisdom, I mean, it had been snowing for 3 fucking weeks.
Right.
So when the weather got good, you know, the face was in pretty horrible condition. We spent one night below the Rote Flue, did the Hinterstoisser, got up, climbed up onto what would be the second ice field. So climbed the really nice two pitches in the ice hose or whatever, pitch and a half. And then John was just like, look, dude, there's too much snow. I was super ambitious still. I'm like, also, you know, scared.
Right.
But thinking that the right thing to say was, no, let's go up. Anyway, wisdom prevailed. We went down, passed. But on our way down, Christophe Profi and Sylviane Tavernier were on their way up. And Profi was short roping her. You know, John and I had been belaying pitches. We were super slow, and they're just moving super fucking fast. And he's short roping her. And they got up a little bit. I think they got up to the Hinterstoisser and turned around at that point. We meet them later in the bar. So, you know, outside some hotel, and we're just like, and John's just like, ah, oh, fuck, I got to go home. And And Profi looks at me and he's like, oh, you, and I said, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to try and, you know, I want to do more climbing. And Profi was, you know, in the English that he had at the time, he's just like, oh, you must come to Chamonix because it's the best in the world, you know, as French folks, French climbers certainly do. And he's not wrong. He said, you must come. So John got on a plane home. I took a train to Cham and soloed 5 big routes there that fall. Wow. And then went back for 4 months the following summer. Ended up that summer with I climbed the Walker Spur, the northeast face of the Piz Bedil, and the north face of the Eiger with Eric Perlman. A dude from Colorado named Alan Bradley was with us on the Eiger. And I climbed the Bonatti route on the Grand Cap, Jeff Lowe. That was when I first met him. He made a free ascent. I made a follow the rope ascent. It wasn't a great year because I got there, had made plans to climb with Roger Baxter Jones, and he'd been killed with a couple of clients on the north face of the Triolet, like probably 3 or 4 days before I arrived. And so I got to Chamonix, went to his house. His wife at the time, Christine, was there, and she's just like, he's gone. And first climbing mentor, Dave Kahn, had already, he got killed in 81, like shortly after our trip in the Tetons, he got killed on the Drew. And so those were sort of first couple of experiences with, you know, that something that became a really big part of my climbing career was, you know, all the people who died. And so I left my shit at a place where I was staying, got on a train, I don't know why I thought it would be a good idea to go to Switzerland and solo the North Ridge of the Piz Bedil, but I thought it would be a good idea. And I went with a girl I'd met on the train down from Amsterdam and had a wonderful time, you know, kind of hiking and cruising around in the right there on the sort of Swiss Italian border. Soloed that route, came down, realized, okay, my head's fine. I don't have to worry about myself in relation to the stuff, and took the train back to Chamonix and then that. And then stayed for another, whatever it was, 3.5 months.
Well, yeah, let me ask you that. So kind of projecting myself into that situation at that age. So we're talking early 20s.
Yeah, 23.
Yeah. You know, did that, those things, like you just said, oh, you made plans with the guy and then you showed up and he was gone.
Yeah.
I mean, did it just bounce off of you, do you think?
Oh, fuck no.
No?
No. I mean,
how did you internalize it? Did it?
It didn't, if it had bounced off, like I would have called somebody else, you know,
oh, right.
Like gone to the neighbor's house and gone, you know, or whatever, right. You know, the thing was, but I had already, you know, sort of established this relationship when I'd been there the year before with RBJ I don't know. It was a weird thing. It was like, how could he be just he was just here.
Right.
I had a really strong emotional response to it. And I mean, I have the typical gallows humor that, you know, been around a lot of death people have, but I'm also incredibly sensitive. If there are certain, you know, there are certain people, you know, who were very important to me in my life and climbing career that if they bring up their names, man, I can't help, you know. I just start crying especially when it's, someone very, you know, very important, someone that, like, I'd been through stuff with, or someone who had shone a light on something that, you know, made me go in a certain direction, or, you know, someone that I loved. And I think the reason that I left at that point after, Christine told me that Roger had died, was because I wasn't sure how I was going to react. Because when I learned that Dave had been killed, I mean, they were on the Drew and they'd climbed it and they were coming down and they hung the rappel and he was it's a guy I've corresponded with recently. His first name is Bill, who was with him. And Dave just said, I'll just solo back up and get it. And, you know, pull off flake or something on, you know, when he was there with no rope. And I remember exactly how that felt, that, like, oh, I had plans. And it was, I'd gotten a card, you know, the postcard from Dave, you know, 2 days before or something, saying that Chamonix, it's the center of the universe for alpine climbing. Or he actually used the word cynosure, which I had to look up because I didn't know what it meant. But he said, you know, this is the this is the cynosure of alpine climbing fucking universe, and you got to come here sometime. And then, you know, a couple days later or whatever, some, you know, and this gets kind of muddled together, but at some point, you know, right around the time that card arrived from him, this guy, Paul, who's manager of the Early Winter Store, and I was actually working at the store at that point, came out and said, hey, Mark, you got to come back, man. I got to tell you something. I got some bad news. And again, like, how could he be gone? He was just here. And so one of the reasons that when that summer when I got to Sham and found out that, Roger had been killed was, I didn't know what was going to happen. Like, should I trust myself? Because I had soloed 5 big routes, 6 months ago or 8 months ago here or whatever it was. And I had those plans again, and I don't know what's going to, like, how my brain is going to be. I need to go do something and not here. And then when I got the good feedback or whatever from Soul in the North Ridge of the Peace Bedil, like, okay, I'll be, you know, at least my brain's going to be okay. I don't know about, like, my desire, but I know that I'm not, at least I can trust myself to make decent decisions.
Right. Well, the thing about Chamonix, and I don't know if it's, again, we deal with all these myths in climbing a little bit when we're remote from it, when we're not there in Chamonix. But it feels like, especially as these advances in alpinism are made, that, or when a lot of people there switch to flying and things like that, that just, like, you know, death there.
Death sport is, capital of the world is what I like to call it.
Yeah, it's like pretty common.
Yeah.
And in Kiss or Kill, the book somewhere, you know, you describe a moment on the street of Chamonix where, you know, there's just sort of a casual accounting of somebody's death.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well then, you know, I've got some errands to run. I'll see you later. Kind of a vibe. And so how were you, as those things were happening, I'm kind of curious as to why one person might hang it up or be deterred and you push forward closer to your own possible demise, because that's been a big, I think, theme in your climbing, at least in that era, is to get closer to this edge, or each season, you know, pushing it a little bit further towards whatever the limit might be.
Drugs. No, I mean, the reference there is, you know, to being an addict of some kind, is that, you know, what got you off last year is not going to get you off this year.
Right.
And what test you passed last year will no longer be a test this year. I need something harder to validate myself. And a big part of, like, the pressure cooker situation in Chamonix was, like, maintaining one's place in the food chain. And what you did last year doesn't fucking matter. It's like, who's doing what right now? And, you know, and even if it's a sort of an unspoken hierarchy in that way, everybody, and there's not formal competition, but everybody knows what everybody else is doing. In that period, like from sort of 84 through, I mean, I finally, you know, was there for whatever, 3 weeks in 84, 4 months in 85, about six. Well, let's see, no, only a month or so in 86, then 87 there for in the winter for, you know, another month or so on the tail end of a Himalayan trip. Moved there full time in 88, stayed 5 years, finally left in 1993. So from that period, 84 to 93, the shit that was happening there, in terms of evolution of, you know, not only climbing and the enchainments that were getting done. Now it may seem totally pedestrian, but when Christoph Profi climbed the, you know, the north face of the Eiger, north face of the Matterhorn, and the north face of the Grand Jurasse in the summer, albeit, you know, he did do the shroud on the Grand Jurasse, so not the Walker, but and liaison between them all by helicopter. And that in sort of a, I'd say single push it, but it was like a 24-hour period, essentially, right, when that went down. That was fucking huge.
Right.
I mean, I still have the copy of, you know, the copies of two of the French magazines that came out at that time. He's on the cover. He's fucking running down off, like, he's actually running, you know, down off of the Eiger, I think. And, like, holy fuck, this is possible? This is fucking madness. And here I am, you know, thinking I'm going to, you know, solo the Drew Couloir or something like that. And that's going to be it certainly would stretch me to my limits at the time. But what was happening with him, with Eric Escoffier, who, you know, that following summer of 86, I mean, he climbed an 8A sport route. He'd done the Crows with Daniel Lacroix in the winter, and then he climbed 3 8,000 meter peaks in a month, like all in the same fucking year. And you're like, oh, this dude is like climbing 8A and like throwing down in the Himalayas, and this is what's happening. And right. Okay, now now you put paragliders into this situation. And then all of a sudden, people are flying off of shit. People are thinking they're going to fly off of shit, but they don't. And so there are dudes burning in left and right. And there's the whole fascination with, you know, young French men and cars. And that's producing issues. I mean, Escoffier's climbing career is basically cut short by a car accident, because the whole deal was, if you have to go to Grenoble, then on the drive back to Chamonix, the run is in the canyon just north of Albertville. And who's got the fastest time? And it's and all of these guys were like, Michel Fauquet was in the running for that. Eric Belin, Escoffier. I mean, all those top guys, if they had to go visit a magazine in Grenoble, they would, they'd try and fucking take the record on the way back. And Escoffier, unfortunately, came around one of those corners and there was a gigantic fucking boulder in the road. And so from there, he took up paragliding, and then he crashed the paraglider, and then, fused hip, and it was just, like, fucked up all kinds of ways. And the aggression with which guys were doing stuff in the mountains was insane. And to be there and to be like, oh, I'm nowhere on, I mean, I'm not a part of this part of the food chain. Like, I'm not jumping off. Well, no, that's not true, because I did take my first paraglider flight. Courtesy of John Bouchard, in sort of November 86, and flew for a couple of years and did some, I got involved in that scene, flew off a couple of routes in the Alps that I had climbed to get back down to town. I think I carried on in the Alps. I think I carried my paraglider on, I want to say, 7 routes and flew twice.
Okay,
it's just not like the thing.
Yeah,
mad period.
Well, I mean, you probably just swept up in it, right?
And it becomes normal,
right?
In a way, like, oh, like if I went home and told people what was going on here, like, no one believes it, in a way. I mean, there were a couple, my friend Jonathan Carpenter, when Bouchard was started, when he started Feral Paragliders and was making, I had a fucking, 4.4 pound paraglider, in 87,
right,
that he'd made that, and we were flying with our climbing harnesses and it was like the cut, the sort of cutting edge / bleeding edge of what was happening at that time. And so there were a couple of, Jonathan, he got kind of swept up in my enthusiasm about the whole paraglider thing. And it's going to be the tool to allow, big enchainments to happen in the mountains. Cause you climb this thing and you fly down and you land at the base of the next thing, you pack it up. It got put together by a couple of people. I mean, Alain Gersin and Fred Vivant both did big enchainments using paragliders. So it was easy to get, just their enthusiasm and apparent competence with it,
right?
Which is kind of a fallacy, because it was a whole bunch of really good climbers just believed they were going to immediately also be good pilots. And it's not the same, turns out. And, Bruno Cormier, founder of Vertical magazine, burned in. Guys were trying to fly from Chamonix to Martigny, like the first big cross-country flights. And any number of people got fucked up with paragliders, and for the longest time, I'm not an air sports person. Like I thought it was, a number of friends who've either gotten really fucked up or dead with paragliders or base jumping, and it's not. I know where that road ends for me if I go down it.
Right. Well, speaking of roads ending, what was the movement out of Chamonix then? You could be that old gringo guy that, is drinking pastis on the boulevard there in Chamonix still and reminiscing.
Pontificating about back in the old days. For sure. But there was a...
Is there a French word for gringo?
Rican. So, you take the A off of, the AM off American and okay. AME, and you put an apostrophe there, and you're like, you're a Rican.
Okay.
But I was a Rican, but I could speak. So, I got a pass. So, I had been soloing mostly, and occasionally I'd climb with a partner, when I was living there. And and just realize the cultural differences. Like I've, you know, tried to climb a couple times with Chuki. And we actually took a trip to, you know, Kazakhstan in the winter together. I did a little bit of climb with Alan Gersen, Jean-Christophe Lafay. We climbed together a little bit, but I just didn't rest. Like the thing, like I just didn't, like, if we're going to use the rope, we're going to put in anchors, right? I don't like going up to a belay anchor and seeing one piece, you know, with no gear in between, or like leading on a single 8 mil. Now it'd be, you know, it's different. Rope technology is different now, but leading on a single 8 at that time, which some of those guys thought was just fine, like I didn't resonate with. And so I started, Scott Backe's, who I had formerly met in Chamonix with Michael Gilbert in 89. He'd come over for a month. We got totally shut down by bad weather, did nothing. And then in the autumn of 93, it was shaping up to be one of the best mixed seasons I had seen. And I called him and I said, dude, I'll buy the plane ticket, but you need to get here. And Scott had a flexible enough work schedule that he got on a plane. And so that's what we did, the first ascent of Birthright and the first ascent of There Goes Neighborhood. And I'd realized at that time, like I'd stopped soloing. The last hard route that I'd soloed, I think it was March of 92. I was more in, you know, I'd tried one or two things after that, but I didn't have the head for it anymore. And I don't know. I mean, the reason I stopped soloing is because I realized I'm not willing to die for these routes now, whereas before I was. And some of those things, I mean, if you look at the reality bath, for example, in the Canadian Rockies, that's February 88. This is the first ascent. It's not been repeated because people are, you know, people have less of a, you know, we're less maybe like careless with their lives than Randy and I were when we did it. And, but that changed for me. And I recognized that, like, if I want to climb as hard as I technically am able to do, I need to have a partner and I need to have a rope, because we are, you know, now people are falling off stuff. And so when I was a bit fed up with France, I had tried to buy, you know, property there. It was made particularly difficult for a foreigner. I thought I would stay there. I visited the States and Canada a couple of times in the winter. I was, there was a point there, sort of 92, I came out for a trade show or something and then spent a bunch of time climbing here, actually in Salt Lake. And then I went to the Canadian Rockies. Chris Noble and I had started working on a book, sort of a thing that North Face was maybe part of and this and that. And we'd shot a bunch of pictures here in the Canadian Rockies. And I realized, like, I really liked road trips and I liked trucks. And then Brent's Hawks, I was on a, you know, up in the Tetons at some point and it was too shitty to go climbing. And Brent said, hey man, let's go to the shooting range. And then that just opened up all of a sudden the sort of period of competitive shooting.
There's not a shooting range in Chamonix.
No, it turns out sort of like early 1940s there was, but
yeah, right.
But I'd come back and had enough of a taste of the good parts of the American West that I wanted to be here. So we did. Moved here to Salt Lake, and for a bunch of years, I was not as good of a climber.
Let me ask you a couple more questions before we leave Chamonix altogether. When you're talking about soloing on these routes, and this is just a little technical counter question, but we're talking about free soloing, or are you rope soloing hard pitches? What does that look like?
Free soloing always. Because to me, it's just like it's movement based.
Right.
And it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't looking to do like the hardest technique. It wasn't hard mixed climbing.
Right.
I mean, but I mean, some of the routes that I climbed, I mean, I guess they would be considered hard. I mean, I think it's considered hard until someone skis down it.
Right.
And then after that, it's no longer, you know, you can't call it hard anymore. So like the Super Couloir, which is, you know, it's got, I don't think there's anything vertical on it, but it's, you know, sort of 85-ish. And these are like basically frozen waterfalls that form in the mountains, or sometimes they're quite thin. North Face of the Grand Charmoz, every North Face in the Argentière Basin, I think I made the first solo ascent of the Boisvin-Gabarou route on the North Face of Les Droites, which it's a thin, hard ice climbing,
right.
You know, but like I said, it's movement. Like if the rope comes out, I mean, the rope comes out, you lose a bunch of time.
Right.
And that's if you have a partner. The rope comes out by yourself, then it's even more so. Unless, you know, let's just say, I mean, now, you know, okay, how am I going to handle, how am I going to like hang my pack and, right. you know, do all this shit, and I'm going to rope solo and I'm going to wrap down and I got to fucking clean the thing because I'm going to need some gear up. This like doesn't make sense.
Right. Well, I've just always tried. I mean, the alpine climbing is tricky for me because of my limited experience with it. So viscerally, I'm always trying to think about what it feels like having free solo rock climbing, you know, and then you read about, I'm not sure what we feel about Thomas Cézanne's claims about the kind of things that he climbed in his plastic boots.
Yeah.
Which sounds incredible to me.
Guy was a fucking good climber.
You know, so Stevie Hassan described to me soloing a hard route in Chamonix, same sort of thing, like 5'11 climbing in the wintertime type of operations.
Yeah, so like
kind of like
a big thing that he did, like he soloed the Walker and Walker Spur on the Grand Traverse in the winter in like 8.5 hours.
Right.
I mean, that guy, that's baller with a capital B, what that guy has done in his life, reinventing himself for different forms of climbing, for snowboarding down Cho Oyu. I mean, amazing. And I mean, that's a 4,000 foot route. And it's not, like, you can't see your house from there. You know, many routes in Chamonix, like, I think, let's see, from Beyond Good and Evil and Birthright, I could, and There Goes the Neighborhood, I could bivouac on those routes. I could look down and see my house.
Oh.
Like, or the house I rented.
But that's like,
which is a very weird thing to be like, I'm about to die, and there's a, you know, and there's people with binoculars, you know, or whatever. Like,
like Iger sanction.
Yeah. Little. Good weather, bad weather, our weather is good for climbing.
Right.
Which, by the way, the intro to the podcast is...
Thank you. Yeah, I got to it. I think I just got to it first. part of the whole getting there first helped with that one. So. Yeah. But yeah, so the Chamonix thing, I really find an interesting contrast to like what ended up being sort of your, what became kind of your Alaska part of your career. And I kind of want to ask a little bit about, so you moved to the West, you started climbing back in this part of the world.
Yeah.
You know, Canada, Alaska. You had already made relationships with like Barry Blanchard and those folks having climbed in Chamonix.
Well, so I met Barry, would have been February of 88 in the Canadian Rockies.
Okay.
And then that later that year, so he and Ward Robinson and Kevin Doyle, they were, and Albie Soule actually had permits to go to Nanga Parbat and Everest. And Albie had to drop out. And so they were looking for a fourth. Barry ran, you know, they found us. They, you know, Randy and I had the Wild Things climbing team, you know, Ford Aerostar on the Banff Jasper Parkway. And one day it was frozen and we were stuck at the base of the Weeping Wall. And Barry showed up, and I think he might have been with Ward. Or maybe he was with Peter Arbeck. Anyway, he showed up. We started talking. The next day, we went climbing. We did Carlsberg together, and after, you know, we climbed Carlsberg together, he goes, "Hey, dude, do you want to go to Himalayas?" It's like all expenses paid trip of your dreams, sort of. Except it's might be a nightmare depending on.
Right.
And so we had already done those two trips together, but like I moved to Chamonix full time on the way back from Nanga Parbat. Like, I got on a plane in Pakistan, and I got off in Geneva with my two duffel bags, and that was it. And then when he and I went to Everest, which was some months, you know, we had very little time in between those two trips. When I came back from that, I was fully ensconced with my 90-day tourist visa.
Right. Just don't walk. Just don't go through the border.
Exactly.
Did you, is the Nanga Parbat, is that the finding of the pack?
That is the finding of the pack.
Okay. I can't
let that go. That is more like, no, that is the losing of the ropes is
the
what
losing
that
of the ropes. Right, right.
That's
right.
How I prefer to see it as opposed to the finding of the pack, which was just like the happy ending.
Yeah. I mean, so I can't let that go.
No, you can't.
I know. Sorry.
Oh, fuck.
I mean, it's in Kiss or Kill, but yeah, it's pretty much a story we can't just leave behind.
It might. I'm just going to pour a little more.
Okay.
This does say it's whiskey.
I mean, this is, I'll just preface this. This is one of the great climbing stories. I mean, I don't know. It's an incredible story. So just, lay into it, man.
If I treat anything too lightly, call me out. 'Cause,
okay.
I mean, I mean, I'm comfortable with it. It took some years to mentally readjust to the new reality after that. But Barry and Kevin and Ward, they had a permit for to climb the RuPaul face of Nanga Parbat, which above water has the greatest relief of any mountain in the world. I think Mauna Kea or something, like some island somewhere, which has more if you could climb that deep into the ocean. But it's 14,000 vertical feet of relief. It had been climbed once at that point in 71 by a large, I think it was at heart a German expedition, but we can't call Reinhold or Gunther Messner German. They're from South Tyrol. So they were on that trip, and it basically took that team 3.5 months of fixing ropes and stocking all the high camps and that kind of thing to get up to a point where they could leave the fixed ropes behind and go to the summit and get back down. I think so two guys had maybe already done, two of the team had already done it, and then Reinhold and Gunther went up second or it was the reverse of that. But anyway, Reinhold and Gunther had gotten to the top. And they had taken the decision to try and descend the Diemir face down the other side because they thought it was too far, too dangerous, or too wasted, whatever the decision was. So they start going down with no knowledge of, a giant face. It's only like 4,000 feet shorter than the RuPaul. So descending a massive Himalayan peak into unknown terrain.
To where?
To where you're going to be, like when you end up, where you can, unfortunately, Gunther died in an avalanche on that descent. Reinhold survived, and so this face, like when we got there, I mean, there's like Nanga Parbat. It sort of sits off on its own. It's not yet the Karakoram. I think it's still called part of the Himalayan range, but it gets a lot of serious fucked up weather, and a lot of people had been killed. I think we were when we got there. The total number, because I'm pretty sure I wrote an essay called 60 while I was there, which would have meant to me that 56 people had been killed on that mountain already, and I was, we were going to be
the next four.
Yeah, 57, 58, 59, right. 60, whatever. So the idea, even though they had taken 3 months, the idea for us was to climb it in alpine style. So
right. And isn't that sort of the scene of kind of breaking Messner's, Reinhold's anyway, like, feeling towards that kind of climbing, or did he go on to keep doing that?
No, he went on to keep doing that. He actually came back and soloed Nanga Parbat shortly thereafter.
No, I meant like the siege style,
for the siege style thing, for sure. I believe that would have been the very last one,
right?
And then it started on the whole alpine style and the Himalayas thing, and
soloing. That's what I meant. Not his career as a Himalayan climber. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, because it was. I mean, he's written a book about that, and it's harrowing, and he lost his brother. And then there was a strange controversy about all around his brother dying and just kind of crazy.
I mean,
bullshit.
It's just like the politics and backstabbing and the shit that you would never do up there to your brother, your rope mate or whatever. But back down in the valley, everyone's fair game. And the fucking dirty laundry comes out. But anyway, so the idea was to try and do it in alpine style. And based on the acclimatization that we had sort of done, or the idea, we're just like, okay, we're going to take 5 days of food, 7 days of fuel, and we're going to get this thing done. Cause how hard can, it's like, it's four north faces of the Alps stacked on top, or three north faces in the Alps stacked on top of each other. And one of them, the first one's super fucking easy. Like, we're hiking.
Sure. What the hell?
What the hell? It's just like, it's south facing. It's going to be warm. We won't need that many clothes.
But isn't the first one already higher altitude than anything in the Alps?
Yeah. I mean, not totally, but base camp, the base camp that you could hike to in the sort of meadow where the sheep and all that shit are, it's like 11,500 feet or something.
Oh, yeah, no big deal.
So like there is, there, it's, yeah. I will tell you that when you land a paraglider at 11,500, it's fast.
Okay.
Especially if it's like, 88 and you're like got a 3-to-1 glide ratio on it. But
this is a climbing podcast, sir.
Sir, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Nobody listening does either.
Yeah, 3-to-1, that's a 45 degree slope. Just,
okay.
That's not flying, that's falling.
Roofers are just perked up.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, so there was a variety of acclimatization measures taken, et cetera. And we launched on the face and, you know, with a, you know, it seemed barometric, you know, there's no weather forecast back. Like now, if you sort of think about the technology now and you're realizing like guys are getting weather forecasts for Everest and how high the jet stream is going to be and how low it's going to, you know, what the winds and the temperatures and the, you know, from dudes sitting in, you know, at universities and places in other parts of the world, it's a pretty incredible thing. We were kind of flying by the seat of our pants. We had altimeters and it's like, all right, barometric pressure looks good. We need to go. And so we launched and the amount of climbing, and if I had these notes here, I mean, it was stupid because the idea back then was like, you can do 1,000 feet a day because that's what you can adapt to. And I think the first day we climbed 4,000 vertical feet and the next day it was, you know, 3,000 or something like that. I mean, we were just like speeding up this face. Ward was not fully acclimatized because he couldn't, during one of the acclimatization ascents, he'd like had these homemade bootliners and totally fried his feet. And so he couldn't come up to 7,000 meters on the shell route, which we had done and spent a night there already. So he wasn't as acclimatized. And the higher we got, the kind of more that showed. And day five, basically, the weather's been perfect for 4 days. And we've climbed up quite high. Day five, we get into the final sort of the hard part, the Merkel Gully, named after Willie Merkel, who perished up there, as I recall, on the other side of the mountain. But we get up into that thing. That opens at around 24,000 feet. And there's hard technical climb. Messner had said, yeah, the opening pitches of the north face of or the Merkel Gully are as hard as the north face of the Matterhorn. And so, you know, we're actually having the ropes out and we're belaying and there's ice climbing involved and there's ice screws being placed and there's,
you know, it slows way down.
It slows way down.
Right.
I mean, we had a pretty good, actually a pretty good system for moving as either two teams of two or one of four.
I was going to ask that. Yeah.
A bit complicated, you know, that's how we were operating. We had two independent teams of two to start. And then once we got up there, we, you know, it doesn't make any sense for two guys to be take, you know, it makes sense to have one guy lead and the other guys, you know, come up behind.
Right.
But we only had two ropes. And so it's basically, you know, one guy's on a kind of a cow's tail climbing with another guy. So there's two guys on the end of one rope and then one guy on the end of the other. And at this point, like I was, when the storm hit, like I just put it that way, we claim it was utter surprise.
Right.
But looking back after we, you know, but later then looking back after and seeing the film, like the clouds had been boiling all day and it's evident in the pictures, but we were so fucking focused. We had no idea until basically this, you know, over sort of an 1 hour period, this cloud dropped, enveloped the summit, and then the thunder and lightning started. And I was at a period of my climbing career where I didn't wear a helmet. So I actually had like a baseball hat because it had a visor on it to keep the snow off my goggles or whatever. And
I'm sorry, but that image is like, that just got me. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, Boston Bruins, yo, right here.
Flat brim, you know, like I wish it had been that cool. But,
all right.
But it actually
was that some sort of Chamonix thing?
Well, no, that would have been a headband.
Okay. But,
and that's what I was wearing on day one.
Okay.
So what had happened, like anyway. Day one, I was wearing a headband and it was south facing, so it was super hot. And day two, I was just like out of my head. And so I'd like basically gotten sunstroke on the first day or some kind of heat injury, sunburned the top of my head. Barry had looked down on the top of my head when I was following a pitch at some point, and he's like, oh, fuck. That's why he's all fucked up, because I'm just like lobster red head. So he'd given me this baseball hat to wear after that.
And, that's so and
then,
ridiculous.
And then recovered, and I got strong again. You know, that's I got cool. Like I got the sunstroke went away or whatever the fuck. We're up there in the Merkel Gully, and the thunder lightning starts happening, and I've got this baseball hat on, and there's some point I recall distinctly thinking that I am being stung by bees.
Right.
Because like I'm just, so there's a metal button.
Right, the metal button, I was about to say. Yeah, that thing's lighting up.
The metal button is attracting this electricity. And so I'm just getting like zapped in the head. And I'm like, fuck. And I'm like trying to swat these bees. And Barry's looking at me like, "You, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, you having some kind of seizure?" I'm like, "No, man, there's these bees." And he's like, "Dude, take your hat off." And so they were wearing, and they had these, we all had these, those guys did, they had, Sun Ice had made them these suits, and in the hood of the suit was a piano wire, So you could shape or make the edge, the brim of the hood smaller to protect yourself from the, and those things were just like almost like Jacob's ladder, like like the electricity traveling along the wires of their hoods. And I'm just like, okay, now, and it's louder than anything I could, like I'd been to some shows. I'd been to some loud rock concerts.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's rock and roll.
Except it's only the drummers here.
Right.
You know, or the guy playing the synth is just going like, you know, whatever, you know, Trent Reznor figured out was music later. But this was, I mean, it was just like when the thunder itself went off, there's just this constant buzzing noise like that. And then when the thunder went off, it was loud. I mean, it was, it shook. I think if we hadn't been out of food, I would have shit myself. Like, it was like that. And Barry and Kevin, they were just like, hey, we need to dig a snow cave and we'll just wait this out. Cause that's what you do in the Canadian Rockies. That's what, you know, Bonatti did. That's what all those, like all the fucking masters did. And so we're up in this little basin above the Merkle Gully itself, the Ford opens up, and we're sort of a bit less than 1,000 feet below the summit at this point, I think. And thinking, okay, storm's going to, you know, it's an afternoon thunderstorm, no problem. It's going to clear out. We'll get to the summit tomorrow. So they start trying to dig a cave, and everything has been avalanched away at this point. It's like filling up in the bowl part of the funnel and then shooting down the stem. And we're above there in the bowl, and they dig and dig, and they can't like go like 2 feet deep and hit rock, and go 2 feet deep over another place and hit rock. And so we realize like, fuck, we can't get a cave here. There's no place to put the tents up. We need to get back down to the base of the gully and this overhanging rock wall and get under that, or it's going to get, because the snow is just getting worse and worse and worse. And
can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah.
So when you guys are climbing in a team of four, definitely a hierarchy in climbing abilities is going to be apparent.
Yeah.
But when you're making these decisions, like, do you guys have a leader? Do you have someone that's being deferred to? Is there a discussion, or just like, is it all instinct? Or is there, what's the combination of all that?
So right then we were actually down in terms of decision-making capacity. We were down to three because Ward was really altitude sick.
Right.
And he had been for the day prior. He'd, you know, as soon as we kind of got above 23,000 feet where he had not acclimatized to that level.
Right.
He was just slowing down. He was sick. So we're just like, all right, just getting back. We'll take care of everything. You know, as long as you can keep going. He's just like, yeah, I can follow the steps. I can keep going. But he wasn't, in cognitive terms, part of any decision making.
Right.
So that's what I said. Barry and Kevin were like working, you know, to try and get this cave. And I was with, you know, and Ward and I were sort of partnered up at that point. And so a little bit of decentral, you know, there's not like, you know, there's no vote. There's not rock, paper, scissors. It just, it's a difference between, you know, somebody says something that makes sense.
Right.
Let's do that. Somebody says something doesn't make sense. Like, it doesn't make sense, man. Come on. Let's do something different. Cause that sounds crazy. So at that point there was, I would call us sort of three equals. And then, you know, once we couldn't get the cave, the decision was rapidly made, like, we need to get the fuck out of here. And because it's only going to get worse, we're in the sort of the cone-shaped part of the funnel, and right. We've got like six or seven rappels down this very narrow gully that's very steep. And, you know, we don't have a ton of anchors. Anyway, first couple of rappels went fine. It's like the spin drift coming down the couloir. It's first it's ankle deep, then it's knee deep, and then it's kind of waist deep, but it's just constant.
Right.
So it's not bad. Like, there's no waves.
Waist deep. Yeah. Spin drift constantly. No big deal.
No, I mean, I think I said this the other night. We were in this, or maybe it's in, it's Kristen's movie. We were talking about fear, and I just said, look, above 23,000 feet, you don't give a fuck.
Right.
Like the lack of oxygen sort of reduces your ability to care in some way, at least it did for me. And I think a lot of guys, like, I think they, you know, at high altitude, when they fuck up and die, they're just sort of like looking at themselves making that mistake and not caring. But we started going down, and like I said, the spinners got deeper and deeper and deeper. And then we sort of go over this, you know, little break over, and now it's, you know, the ice that we're sort of having to descend and rappel down is really fucking steep. And so some of the Spindrift is kind of shooting out over our heads, and, you know, at that point, because it's coming off the sort of flat, you know, the ramp and then the steep wall beneath. Get down a little bit further. I've got one, I think one snarg, so the pound-in ice screw that no one will ever, you know, remember unless they're aged. Okay.
Yeah. All right. I got it. A rack of those bad boys.
Yeah. I'm just like, man, that'd make a nice sort of wind chime on the porch.
They do. I've seen them.
Yeah. Anyway, so the four of us are on, we've pulled the ropes. And so the idea was like, basically, you know, somebody guy goes down, gets an anchor, you know, clips in, backs it up with his tools if he can. And, you know, this is before sort of, I mean, it wasn't before the advent necessarily of the Abalakov or the V-thread. But in those conditions, with that amount of snow coming down, it would have been impossible to make one. So we're having to sacrifice screws and figure like, okay, well, you know, we just got to get out of here and we'll figure it out down lower. And fuck it. So at some point, there's four of us hanging on one screw, and it's a single 9/16-inch webbing sling girth hitch to the eye of the snarg. It happens to be the lucky sling that my friend Dr. Zipper made, which has 7-bar tacks instead of 5. And I don't know if that has anything to do with the outcome or not. They're both prime numbers, so both equally powerful. But this one was the lucky one. It was fucking bright orange. And so we're all hanging there when the rumbling from above, which is not thunder. It's like very distinct sound of like the incoming train, essentially. So enough snow had built up in some place that it finally like overloaded the slope and cut loose. And this big avalanche came down, and I mean it hit us, and it drove, and every, you know, we're not all sort of hanging off the ice screw until it hit us, and everybody's sort of standing on their front points, you know, you got a tool in maybe or whatever, and so this thing hits and knocks all of us immediately off. It's so strong, and I'm, you know, and you could say, oh, it lasted 5 minutes or 5 seconds, or it lasted my entire fucking life, you know, it doesn't, time did not matter.
Right.
And it just kept pounding and pounding and pounding. And I was, you know, everybody had their sort of fantasies about what was going to happen. You know, okay, the sling's going to break. And Barry's was that the sling was going to break. And we were just going to get like shot off into, you know, various different orbits in space or whatever. And I thought, oh no, the screw's going to pull. And we're going to all be together in this, like tied to this sling with 250-meter ropes, you know, wrapped around us in a fucking ball, and we're going to be tumbling, you know, 10,000 feet down this face. And then it got quieter, and the pressure got a little bit less, and I got a hand up, and I could reach my ice tool and get my wrist through the sling, and like, and I thought, okay, maybe now if the screw pulls, I'll be able to hold us with my axe.
Sure.
Yeah. As if. And then it stopped altogether.
Uh-huh.
And we're just like, oh my God, the screw didn't rip. The sling didn't break. Like, we are all still alive, I think. Ward, hey. Barry's shaking the ropes and screaming at him, and Ward looks up, and he's just like, you know, face just totally, like, his hood is packed with snow. Like, he was apparently looking up when the thing hit. Hood is packed with snow, packed in all around the goggles. Just fucked up. And he said something, and it's in one of those articles. I can't remember. You know, it was like, kind of thought we were all dead and we're still here kind of thing. And and so we managed to get down out of that gully, and I get off to, you know, get off to the side to into this protection of the overhanging rock, and I start chopping a ledge because Ward is fucked up now. He's hypothermic. He's basically, his one piece suit has been force filled with snow through the hood.
Yeah.
You know, And he'd already been altitude 6, and so now he's got a bunch of shit. We got to take care of Ward. So I start chopping a ledge so we can get the stoves out and you know, make some hot drinks and get him warmed up. Maybe we can get him in a sleeping bag, you know, whatever. And I'm just trying to separate myself from the incident. I was the humanitarian. I was digging the ledge. I was taking care of the ill guy, you know, and that leaves Barry and Kevin. And so the last rappel down, the sort of couloir splits into two, and there's a giant rib of rock, and the anchor was on one side of that rib of rock sticking up, and we needed to get on the other side. So, you know, I had done it, and Ward had done it, and then Barry had done it, and then Kevin was up above, and I think it's Kevin, and he basically shouts, like, we're concerned that if we try to pull the ropes, the knot is going to hang up in this rib of rock. and the storm is still raging, and it's 10 o'clock at night. We've been up and since 5, and we've been on the face now for, it's the end of day 5, and so we're not that coherent.
Right.
One of the guys said, basically says, like, hey, I'm just going to drop the ropes and down climb. I'm going to let go of the ropes and down climb. And then somebody heard, down below, okay, he heard let go of the ropes.
Right.
And so when the ropes got kicked off from the anchor above, they got let go from the bottom. And so the only two ropes, we're 13,000 feet up this face, and the only two ropes we have, which we are going to need to get down, disappear into the night. No one notices. Because, one guy's like, okay, I just, Kevin, like, I'll just say it's Kevin up above. I can't remember. He just, tossed the ropes down and, no longer his responsibility because somebody else had the other end. And then when, as we'll say, there's Barry at the bottom and he let go and he tossed the ropes because he heard Kevin tell him to let go of the ropes. He didn't know what was going on. So both the ropes just sail off into the night beyond headlamp range with all the spindrift and all the shit coming down that out of that gully and they disappear. We start taking care of Ward. We get some hot drinks in us. I'm like, okay, we're going to down climb to our last bivvy station or bivvy site where there's already a ledge chopped. We'll put the tents up. So I think Barry and I have each have a tent in our packs. So we go down first. Kevin's taking care of Ward. We go down and I'm trying to put up one of the tents on the ledge and these old sort of Bibbler style tents where the poles go inside, to put the bend in the pole to get the secondary end of the pole in through the front door, you got to hold onto the tent really fucking hard.
Right.
And so I was like pushing on the pole and not holding onto the tent hard enough. I like developed enough tension in the pole that when I accidentally let go of the tent, it basically shot off the end of the pole into space. And I watched it like disappear down the slope. And Barry looked up and at that point I was like taking the tent poles and folding them back up. And he's like, what's going on? I said, I just dropped the tent. He looked up kind of like right at the point when I was throwing the tent poles off because there's no tent. I don't need to carry the fucking poles anymore. So I get a shovel and I start digging a snow cave. And so we the other two guys get down. Ward gets in the cave with me. Kevin and Barry get in the tent. And then the next morning we wake up, it's still stormy. Obviously we're not going to the summit and our 5 days of food is out and we've got 2 days of fuel left with which we can melt snow and drink. So,
and no ropes.
And no ropes, but we don't know that yet. We know we only have one 2-person tent
right.
left and shovels. So, we're kind of packing everything up and Ward's like, hey, the yellow rope, it's always been my responsibility and I don't see it. Do you guys have it? And all four of us looked at you and this is, looked at each other like, holy, no, I dropped him. No, you pulled him up.
So you're 10,000 feet off the ground.
We're about 12 now.
Yeah.
Because it's basically down right. climbed 1,000 feet
right.
out of the bottom. So we're about, 23, something like that. I mean, it's no rope. We realize, okay, there's no ropes. And we're like, oh, well, the storm's not going to start. There's, I guess we're down climbing. And we had done some really hard pitches to avoid a big wind slab in the middle of this Merkel ice field at some point. And I was like, oh, fuck. And I was, I was fairly confident that if the gods needed a human sacrifice, it wasn't going to be me. I was like, Ward, he's sick. They always take the sick, right?
Right.
They don't take the good guys. So I was pretty convinced something bad was going to happen. It was going to happen to Ward, and that Barry and Kevin and I were going to get down. It's not malicious, or anything. I was just like, okay, the obvious candidate for fucking up right now is him because he's altitude sick. He's been hypothermic. He's like been, he's been getting beaten up for the last 2 or 3 days. So, we go down, we have to down climb the wind slab and we go and it's fucking booming. I mean, it was really scary and we got off the bottom of it and nothing happened. I'm like, okay, that's cool. And we had seen in the Welsenbach couloir on the way up, we had seen like there were some bits of tat, some fixed, some old fixed ropes some of it looked like water ski rope, like stupid fucking polypropylene, yellow three braid kind of stuff. And I thought, we could probably put enough of that together to get over these steep sections, down climb what we can, And, you know, if a rope breaks, well, it's not going to be any different than if we stay here.
Right.
So keep down climbing. We go and we go and we get to the we get to this choke point where basically if you were on that face and you had to get down, you would end up in this spot. And so all the terrain features like funnel us into the top of the Welsenbachhular, and we're there. And one of the guys spots this totally sun-bleached haul bag or pack, you know, clipped to some fixed pitons. And it's got Japanese writing on the outside of it. And we're looking at it like, huh. Okay. One of the guys cuts it open. Like, we got to see. We're hungry. We're going to be out of fuel soon. I don't know what's in here, but like, it's full of something. Been here for a while, but it's probably still okay. You know, so we cut it open. There's 250-meter ropes, same as our sponsor, which is Edelweiss. There was a dozen eye screws, probably 30 pitons, 40 pitons, something like that. There was canisters for the stove, not the ones that we had, unfortunately. And there were these Cadbury fruit and nut bars. And apparently, so all this, and there was, you know, all this stuff had been put there in 84. There was a Japanese team, and they had fixed ropes up the Rupal, and then three guys had gone to the summit and then disappeared. Like, they're gone. And so the other guys, before they, you know, they waited and they looked around and, you know, dude, what do you do? You know, your friends have disappeared on a big ass fucking mountain in the Himalayas, and you don't really want to leave.
Right.
But eventually you have to. And so they said, okay, the concession is that, look, we'll take everything that they need to get down and survive up to that choke point at the top of the Welsenbachhular. Because if they're going to come back down this way, they're going to get funneled into this spot. So we'll go up, we'll put the gear there. And that's like the only sort of solace they could, you know, give themselves before they split and went back to Japan. And so 4 years later, we get there in basically the same situation because we were about to be disappeared up there. And now we're rappelling like, you know, fucking crazy. We got fucking two-point equalized anchors for every rappel now. And like, it's no longer terrifying. The weather's still bad, but we have the means to get down. So we keep going. We spend one more night, dig one more snow cave on the way down. And eventually, you know, night of day seven, whatever, we get down to base camp. It's fucking pissing rain still. So this storm that we were going to sit out ended up lasting 10 or 12 days. So if we had committed to staying up there to wait out the storm, we'd still be there. And there ensued after that this whole period of, you know, like, do we go back up? Do we not go back? And this and that. The storm eventually clears, and we're stir crazy at this point. We're highly ambitious, and we're young, and we're fucking good at what we do. And so at some point, Kevin was just like, you know, I'm done fucking Himalayan climbing. I'm out of here. And but then Barry and Ward and I start, like, packing to go back up, and Kevin's like, ah, motherfucker. And so he comes with us. And so we launch again after the storm clears. And it basically again, I'd have to go back to my notes, but we got to our previous high point. The high point that, the base of the Merkel Gully, 24,000 feet, we got there in 2.5 days this time. Super acclimatized. We were fit. We were frustrated. Somewhere around 23,000, Ward had said, hey, can you guys give me one of the ropes? I got to go down. I'm fucked. I can't. I'm going to hold you back. Like, fuck. Super ambitious. This could have been a totally turned out the wrong way.
Right.
And, like, would have been, you know, castigated in the climbing community ever since for, you know, leaving the guy. But we're just like, fuck it, he seems fine, you know. So we give him one of the ropes, he starts going down, we climb another 1,000 feet up. We're at the base of the Merkel Gully, you know, where we had gotten fully fucked before, and look up, and there's this huge lenticular over the summit of Nanga Parbat. And all three of us looked at each other, and there was no leader, there was no vote, there was no, we were like, we're fucking going down,
right?
And so from there, we blast. We get Ward on the way down. We descended from 24,000 all the way to base camp in 13 hours. Basically spent the rest of that day packing our shit and drove out, you know, hiked out, drove out the next day. And it was over. And then the punchline, if there needs to be one, is we get back to Nanga Parbat, and you got to have a debriefing by the tourism ministry or whatever. And so we're in there, and, you know, everyone's still got the 1,000-yard stare at least. And the guy asks us, it's like, so how was your experience on Nanga Parbat? And Barry, total straight face, looks at the guy and goes, it was like having sex with death, which, you know, we all laughed.
So, I mean, how long did it take for the root ball face to get climbed alpine style? Because Steve House and...
So he and Vince, he went up, he and Bruce Miller got, I think, pretty high on it in 2004.
Right.
And then Steve went back with Vince in 2005. They climbed a new route.
Oh, okay.
And, I mean, on the RuPaul face, it would be to the right of the Messner route and technically more difficult. And the RuPaul face is sort of the Messner, what we'd call the Messner route, if you will, on the RuPaul face. I think it has been climbed in alpine style.
Okay.
But I don't remember who or the year. I feel like in my sort of fleeting memory that it had been done. But I think, you know, I look back and I go, wow, at the time we were like cutting edge. Well, sort of, but, you know, Earhart and John had already climbed, you know, that was what, 86 when they did the north face of Everest and 43 hours round trip. They climbed the east face of Dalagiri in winter. So that would have been Earhart, Pierre Lensteiner, and I can't remember if John was with him or not, or it was Pierre Morand. Anyway, but like some crazy, like alpine style stuff in the Himalayas had been done. I think the RuPaul would have advanced it in technical terms had we been able to do it. But it did prove some possibility about shit that could get done.
Right. That's a hell of a story. I mean, you know, the pack was everything.
Well, the pack was everything, and so now let me just fast forward. So 3 months from finding the pack, essentially. So Barry and I are at Everest. You know, we're at Advanced Base Camp on the north side of Everest. We're the only couple of people left. Three Japanese people show up on a winter permit. One of them is a guy who was the leader. The leader of that winter trip was a guy who was on the trip in '84 to Nanga Parbat.
Uh huh.
And I want to say that it's. I want to say it's Tsunio Hasegawa. I could be completely wrong on this. I don't remember. And we tell him what happened. He's like, yeah, have you guys been climbing? And I was like, yeah, we just came from Nanga Parbat. And as a matter of fact, we had this thing happen and blah, 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 and this pack. And it was very clear from this interaction that he would have preferred that it had been, that pack had saved his friends rather than us.
Right.
But he was very gracious.
Right.
And we thanked him, you know, profusely, actually, when we found out that he was part of that team that left that thing that, you know, allowed us to survive.
So, I mean, what are we dealing with when we're dealing with guys like you and Barry and Ward and, you know, where you come down from something like that and literally like a few days later, you're like, we should go back up there. You know, where
you're dealing with short memories,
yeah,
and fucking hubris,
right?
You know, jokingly,
right?
You know, but I also think those like that situation that we're sort of 10 days in base camp and we wanted, and I mean, I was hungry because this was my life. You know, it's the most important thing to me in the world, and you know, and Kevin had said something at a point maybe 8 days into that sort of waiting through this storm. He's just like, you know, I have more important things to do in my life, so I'm not going to go back up.
Right.
And
isn't that the question?
And my response to that was basically, I don't.
Right.
Like, this is it. And it's not like, this is it. I'm back into a corner. I have to do this. No, this is what I want to do. I am exactly where I want to be right now. And I was pissed at Kevin when he said that. Because it was kind of a slap in the face from, you know, my chosen career path or whatever. And, you know, but Kevin was just gifted with ridiculous amount of talent, which he then honed. And I mean, the guy was an amazing fucking climber, but he's pretty amazing at whatever he put his mind to. So I could see it, you know, in any case, when you say, what are we dealing with? I think it's the plasticity of the mind in a way of like being able, like, because you step back and it's like, it's absolutely absurd to go back up. It was absurd to think that we could do that in the first place. If the first ascent 17 years earlier had taken 3.5 months, how the fuck did we think we were going to climb up in 5 days and down in two? Like already it's a stretch already. Right. It's like, this is not normal. Like, it's crazy to me in the end what the human mind can adapt to and consider normal and acceptable. And I, all I, if I want to put it in sort of big wall terms, I think I probably shit myself on an A3 pitch once, and I can't imagine what sustained modern A4 would be like for multiple pitches. Like, that level of tension at that intensity, I think I'd blow a fuse. But then you talk to guys who do it, not that bad.
Right.
Because
famously, I have famously stated that it was not that bad.
Exactly. And because you're adapted to it.
Right.
Because
it was past tense.
Exactly. Like, if put me in that situation, and, you know, many climbing situations I would have found myself in during my career where I was adapted to it, put me there today and I'd be, you know, it'd be cool. It'd be a heart attack. It'd just be over right away. But there it is. It's like, through this incremental process of adaptation, we arrive at a point where we can do things that appear ludicrous in a way from the outside. And that's, you know, that'd be my answer. It's like, that's what we're dealing with, is like incremental adaptation.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. And please come back for part two next time on the EnormaCast, where we go deep into Alaska, talk about life after climbing, and Mark reflects on his career and some of the friends he lost. And hey, folks, please don't forget to check your knot.